So thanks everyone for coming. Great turnout. I'm delighted to be able to welcome you to the second lecture in the European Society's What Has Europe Done For lecture series. Very much aimed at everyone, the idea is to kind of highlight key aspects of the European Union's role in the UK. I'm particularly pleased today to welcome Professor McBarnard, who's obviously an amazing lecturer here at the Faculty of Law. Today she will be presenting on the subject of what has Europe done for social Europe, the idea of the social welfare provisions, and also touching on migration. I am fairly confident that she will be happy to answer a couple of questions at the end. So without further ado, can we please welcome her and listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm amazed, as many of you have turned out as you have, given it's wet, it's dark, and it's also week 8 of term. So I'm just going to talk a bit about what social Europe has done and means to me. And I'm going to structure it around three ideas: the good things that social Europe has done, at least for workers, the complicated things, and the underwhelming things. And I'm going to look at each one of those in turn. Let's start with the good news story, at least good news from a worker's perspective. And what's striking is when the Treaty of Rome was drafted, it had almost no social provisions in it whatsoever, because if you'll recall, the Treaty of Rome was primarily about delivering free trade, free movement of goods, persons, services, and capital. And it took a while for the EU to recognise that there was a need for the EU to have something of a social face. And that social face took not a very exciting form, but actually produced some directives which are still really important today. A directive on collective redundancies, so when you get rid of a lot of people, they've got to be consulted. A directive on transfer of undertakings, so that's when a company sells part of its business to another undertaking, another company. The staff have to get transferred across on the same terms and conditions, and some protection for those whose employers have gone bust, leaving them with arrears of salary outstanding. But far more extensive and more impressive, and probably having more impact, were the provisions on equality. Now, the only provision, the only social provision in the original treaty was Article 119 on equal pay for men and women. And that wasn't really seen as having legal effect. It was more sort of exhortatory, wouldn't it be good if. However, two things happened. One, the Court of Justice made Article 57 really hard law and said it was enforceable. And actually, the EU committed itself to delivering gender equality through a whole range of directives. I won't take you through them in turn, but they were consolidated in 2006, but there had been a whole bunch of directives in the mid-1970s, really important directives which gave significant rights to women. And then it became rather odd that women should get so much protection and not other protected groups like those who are discriminated against on the grounds of their race or ethnic origin. And so there were two major directives in 2000. One which gave rights to those who were discriminated against on the grounds of race or ethnic origin, and the other one which gave rights to those who were discriminated against on the grounds of age, sexual orientation, religion, belief, disability. So really quite significant measures. And on the back of those directives which concern gender equality, you've also got a number of directives on which we might loosely group under the heading of family-friendly policies, so directives on pregnant workers, giving rights to pregnant workers, giving rights to parental leave and some protection to the self-employed, and relatedly protection for those who were engaged in atypical work, so part-time work, fixed-term work and agency work. So these were all good things, you might think, and good for the individual workers. And that good continued into the heyday of EU social policy with the adoption of the Community Charter of Fundamental Social Rights, the Community Charter of 89. Now, that charter was Delors' baby, Jacques Delors, the then very dynamic French president of the European Commission. Now, the UK didn't sign up to that charter at first. It was only signed by 11 of the 12 member states. But in fact, that didn't matter very much because there was an action programme that followed up from that charter. And that action programme led to the adoption of some really significant directives which continue to resonate today, in particular the directives on working time, which I'll come back to in a moment, but that gives 4 weeks paid annual leave, 48-hour working week maximum, and then directives on proof of employment contract, perhaps less exciting, protecting young workers, protecting those workers who are posted from one state to another, so temporarily going from one state to another, and lots of health and safety legislation. And it is worth bearing in mind that most of these directives were adopted under a legal basis, so under powers in the treaty, which was introduced by the Single European Act, which Margaret Thatcher willingly, enthusiastically signed up to. And the reason why she wanted to ensure that there was lots of health and safety legislation at EU level was not because she was particularly concerned about the health and safety of workers, but because she knew that our health and safety legislation imposed quite considerable burdens on British employers, and she wanted those same costs to be extended to employers in other member states. And finally, in this Cook's tour of what you get at EU level, there's also a number of directives on giving workers information and consultation. And these directives, they had their origins in the 1970s. They were specific. They required workers to be informed in very specific situations, such as collective redundancies, but also more general directives on information and consultation. So I've given you a Cook's tour of what you've got as a worker, and all of those things are EU directives, and they have all been transposed into UK law. And so you need to think what effect Brexit will have, because if Brexit, if a vote to leave, means that not only is the European Communities Act repealed, the piece of legislation which took us into the EU in the first place, but if the Brexiteers think that the corollary of a vote to leave means that all UK legislation which has been passed to implement an EU directive, what you will see is a loss of considerable worker protection. And that's one of the reasons why the TUC, on balance, is in favour of the Remain. Now, I've given you a list of legislation, probably not very exciting, but I just wanted you to get a flavour of the areas in which the EU has legislated. But I think it's important to recognise the role of the European Court of Justice in this field of social policy. And the Court of Justice has done two things. First of all, the Court has been influential in making sure that this EU legislation really does bite on the ground. In other words, it's effectively operationalised. So what happens if a state, including the UK, sort of partially transposes a directive? Doesn't matter, says the court. The directive can have direct effect, which means that it can be enforced in your local court in Cambridge or wherever the breach of EU law has occurred. And I should say, as a parenthesis, that those who argue that if we leave the EU, it doesn't matter because there's always a WTO. Well, this is a misconception because WTO law does not have direct effect. I cannot enforce WTO law in the local courts in Cambridge. And furthermore, WTO law gives workers no protection at all. At all, not even of this more specific kind that I've been talking about. Now, clearly, if you are anti-EU, you'd think that's a good thing. But this is some of the consequences of voting to leave might mean. So the Court of Justice has been important in actually making sure EU law actually functions on the ground, it's effective. But it's also been important in giving an expansive reading of some of the provisions in the directive. And again, depending on whether you're a worker or an employer, you might think that's a good or a bad thing. I want to just give you a couple of examples. One of the most famous social policy cases is Dufresne against Sabena. Now, this case is important because it concerned the provision on equal pay. And that's Ms. Dufresne, and she was a stewardess for Sabena Airlines in Belgium. And she discovered that air stewardesses were being paid less than male stewards. Straightforward case of direct discrimination. And she wanted to rely on Article 157, the equal pay provision. And that was the one that was in the treaty. Do you remember I said to you it was exhortatory? That's what people thought. Well, not the Court of Justice. The Court of Justice said this is a really important provision. And not only does it mean what it says on the tin, that women should get the same pay as men, but also it's directly effective, which means it can be enforced in the courts in Belgium. And so that's a good example of the court really doing what I first said, ensuring that these rules are enforceable. To give you an example of a case where the court stretches, if you're negative, shapes, if you're more positive, the provisions of EU law, take the case of Coleman and Attridge Law. Now, in the case of Coleman, she was a legal secretary and she had a disabled son. She was a single parent and she wanted to have time off to look after her disabled son, who was often sick because of his condition. And eventually her enlightened employers, a law firm, what would you expect, but her enlightened employers said, sacked her because she was taking time off. Now, she sued for what's known as associative discrimination. And what that means is she sued for disability discrimination, not because she was disabled, but because she associated with people who were disabled. Now, it wasn't at all clear at the time whether the directive covered that situation. But the Court of Justice said in Coleman and Attridge Law, it said absolutely, it extends protection to those who associate with people who are disabled and suffer the consequences, in her case, to be dismissed. Now, there are lots of examples of that taking place, but that just gives you a flavour of how the court has been so proactive in this field. Again, for Eurosceptics, they say this is a bad thing. The court has too much power. It's one of the things that Boris Johnson put in his Telegraph, Daily Telegraph piece when he announced that he was going to leave. You can't trust the Court of Justice. The counter-argument to that is the Court of Justice is trying to do what constitutional Supreme Courts do, which is to make EU law, the law that they are responsible for enforcing, actually operative on the ground. Perhaps the most controversial directive, certainly in the UK, is the Working Time Directive. And as I said to you before, it was adopted under the Social Charter Action Programme immediately after the Community Social Charter of 89. And that directive gives you a maximum working week of 48 hours, and it also gives you time off for when you, for paid holiday. You get 4 weeks paid holiday under the directive. Now, some of the court's decisions on this directive have been deeply controversial and have added significantly to employers' costs. In particular, the decision which has cost health services a lot of money is where the court ruled that so-called on-call work is working time. So that's where you are asleep, crucially at the employer's premises, not in your own bed. You're asleep and yet you can be called at any time. That time counts as working time. And so as you can see, the 48-hour limit racks up quite quickly. There are also decisions about sick leave. People who've been on long-term sick leave, can they take annual leave at the end of their extended period of sick leave? Yes, says the Court of Justice. And most recently, travelling time to jobs. If you're a a travelling salesman, for example, that time will also constitute working time. So from employer's point of view, bad news, these decisions cost money. From an employee's point of view, good news, because they're giving you protection. And these directives are all adopted as health and safety measures. And if you understand them in that, through the prism of health and safety, you can see why the court decided as it did. So I've given you some examples of why EU law, EU social law, can be seen as a good thing from the point of view of workers. And the risk is that from a worker's perspective, if we were to leave the European Union, you would lose a lot of this protection. But it is important to keep these things in perspective. What you might have noticed when I summarised all of that EU legislation was that it is, in fact, incomplete. It is not a recreation at EU level of all of the employment protection you get at national level. You might have noticed I said nothing about dismissal, about unfair dismissal, which is one of the key domestic employment rights. And that's because, roughly speaking, EU law does not touch upon issues such as the formation of a contract, have I got an offer of an employment from you? The terms of the contract, unless they're sex or race discriminatory, and the termination of that contract. Again, nothing to do with EU law unless it is discriminatory. So EU law supplements domestic rights, but does not replace domestic rights and is not comprehensive either. Furthermore, EU law depends quite a lot on national terminology. So it gives rights to employees in some cases, workers in other cases, but who is an employee may be left to the national system to define. So what I've given you hopefully is an overview, a panorama of what EU law says in the social field. And I emphasise the rights I've been talking about apply to everyone who is an employee or worker, irrespective of their nationality and irrespective of whether they have moved or not. Those are rights for basically domestic workers, and they're also rights for migrant workers coming to the UK. But anyone who is a worker gets those rights. I now want to turn to what's more complicated. The story I've told you is basically a story of unadulterated good news for employees because they are getting protection. What's more complicated is the situation where we're dealing with migration. And also it's complicated when we're dealing with language. And what I mean by that is you might have seen the title of my talk was about EU social policy and what EU social policy, what's Europe done for me through social policy. Now, in fact, social policy is a misnomer. And it's a misnomer because if you think about social policy in the domestic context, you would think about benefits, you would think about housing, education, healthcare, higher education, schools, all of that sort of thing. Yet when I gave you that list of EU measures, they didn't touch on any of those core issues of social policy. They touched on employment law, really narrowly defined. So although the relevant chapter in the treaty is headed up, or relevant title in the treaty is headed up social policy, in fact, that's a misnomer, because it's really about employment law. And in one sense, that's not surprising because we're dealing here with a question of competence. And I use competence in the legal sense of the word. And by that I mean, who has the power to do what? And the member states have jealously guarded their power to keep social policy in the much broader sense, education, health, welfare benefits and so forth, as a domestic law matter. They do not, they have never wanted the EU to have a say about these social policy things more generally. Because they say this is what we nation states do for our public, for our people. And so while some people might be critical that the EU doesn't have a more fully fledged social policy, it's only got employment law and partial employment law at that, at the EU level, that's because member states have never wanted the EU to have much larger plans. And can you imagine what the British press would say if you saw EU runs our hospitals, EU tells us what should be taught in schools to our six-year-olds? You can imagine the cries. And that's because these things are seen as very much national issues, issues of national competence. The other area where it's complicated is in respect of free movement. Because in respect of free movement, as we know, the narratives are mixed. Some people think free movement, migration, is a good thing because it brings new skills, new blood, new ideas to the national economy. Others say it's a bad thing because it threatens domestic jobs, and the migrants occupy places in British schools, British hospitals, and so forth. But it's quite clear in the treaty that migration, workers, is a key element of EU law. Article 45 of the treaty gives rights to free movement of persons, free movement of workers. So I've also got the right to go to another member state and work there as an employed person. And indeed, 2 million migrant workers from other EU member states are in the UK. But crucially, there are about 2 million British people in other member states doing the same thing. And just note the terminology. It's migrants who come to the UK, but the British press talk about expats when they're British people going to other member states. But expats is just a fancy term for migrants. They are migrating under Article 45 or possibly under Article 49 as self-employed persons, or even perhaps providing services. Now, Article 45 in the UK is already a really quite vexed issue. And as you know, under Article 45, you've got the right to equal treatment in respect of social and tax advantages. And social and tax advantages mean that you get tax benefits, including tax credits, in-work tax credits. And this was one of the things that David Cameron really resented. And he said, why on earth should migrants be able to claim benefits from day one when they work in the UK because they haven't contributed to the system? Well, the EU answer, the EU law answer to that question is the reason why they get benefits from day one is because our system of benefits is one based on roughly, for some benefits, a sort of universal system of benefits. If you are low paid, you can get top up in terms of tax credit, whether you're British or whether you're migrant. There is no service, no length of residence requirement before you get those benefits. Now, David Cameron was fundamentally opposed to that. And he, in his renegotiation on the 18th and 19th of February, renegotiated what's called an emergency break, which was not a ban on migrants getting an in-work benefits, but what it was a process by which member states who are in some sort of crisis situation, which the Commission says we are, no evidence has been produced, but states who are in a crisis situation can put up a request to the Commission and Council to say, can we stop in-work benefits for 4 years? And the Council can approve the state to not give benefits, but it's not a blanket ban for 4 years. You get nothing at the beginning, and then you get a proportion over the four-year period. So it's not quite what David Cameron wanted. And also in his basket, you've also got restrictions on the exportability of child benefit. Under EU law, under the Social Security regulation, you can export child benefit. So if I'm a Polish worker working here, I can send child benefit back to my children in Poland. David Cameron says this is preposterous. How on earth can that be justified? And so what he negotiated was that you wouldn't get the full rate of child benefit that you'd get in the UK. You would get it proportionate to the cost of living back in Poland. Now, the logic of that is, if I'm a Luxembourg worker working in the UK, of course, the cost of living is much higher in Luxembourg, so it may end up costing the UK more. But there may be some fudge about that when the amendments are proposed. But I think it is worth saying, and some of the work I'm doing at the moment is about looking at the extent to which migrants are being attracted to come to the UK because of benefits. All of the people we've interviewed so far, and we've done a lot, for them, benefits is a sort of bizarre concept. I was in standing interviewing in outside a church in Peterborough on Saturday. It was extremely cold, and there was a church service for Lithuanians. And what's very striking is that while they were deeply suspicious to talk to us, and I understand why, those who we did talk to said, well, the reason why we're here is because pay is four or five times better than in Lithuania. And when you ask them about benefits, most of them just shrugged their shoulders and said, I'm not interested in benefits, I want to work. And this is the message that all of the research brings out. Of course, there are some exceptions. But the main thrust of our work and other people's work is just that people come here for jobs, not for getting benefits. But anyway, they are entitled to benefits under the principle of equal treatment. Now, although I've told you a story so far of why EU law can be a good thing for workers, whether you are a migrant worker under Article 45 or whether you are a domestic worker who hasn't gone anywhere, you are getting rights under EU law. Where the trade unions are more suspicious about EU law is in respect of these treaty provisions, the ones I've listed, like Article 49 and Article 56. Because those treaty provisions have the effect of pitting one group of workers against another. And that's why this section of my talk is described as complicated. And I'll just give you one example. And the example is the case of Viking, which concerns the Rosella, which is that vessel up there, which plies the route between Helsinki and Estonia. And the Rosella was, at that stage, a Finnish-registered boat with Finnish workers working on it. And the owners wanted to re-register the vessel as Estonian so that they could hire Estonian workers and then cut their wage costs. As you can imagine, the Finnish Seamen's Union was not best pleased and called their members out on strike. And what the employers said, that's the Viking Line, you can see the name of the case emblazoned on the side of the boat because that's the name of the employers, Viking Line relied on Article 49 and they said that by going on strike, the Finnish Seamen's Union was interfering, was obstructing Viking Line's ability to relocate to Estonia. And the court agreed. They said strike action is in principle unlawful under EU law unless it could be justified, and there was a justification, namely trade unions trying to protect their members' jobs. But the court gave a strong hint that the strike action was not proportionate. And the effect of the decision in Viking has made it very difficult for trade unions, particularly in this country, where we already have the strictest strike rules in Europe. It's made it very difficult indeed for trade unions to go on strike. And so the downside of EU law is that these treaty provisions can be used in a deregulatory way, taking away national employment rights, such as the right to strike, when those national rights interfere with free movement. So this basically summarises what I've just said, and there was another case decided at much the same time, a case called Laval. And in that case, it was about Latvian workers whose employer won a contract in Sweden to build a school. And the reason why the Latvian company won the contract was because, of course, the Latvian company could do it for less because they were using Latvian workers. And these workers are called posted workers because they temporarily worked in Sweden and then they went back to Latvia. And the Latvian trade unions were very cross and they said, well, these are Latvian workers, they should be getting the same terms and conditions as Swedish workers. If not, they were undercutting Swedish workers. And the employers, the Latvian company, challenged the decision of the Swedish trade unions. The Swedish trade unions decided to boycott, to block goods and services coming onto the site, and eventually the Laval, the Latvian employer, went bust. And the Laval challenged the decision of the trade unions, and again the argument was that what the Swedish trade unions were doing was interfering with the Latvian company's ability to provide services. So what you see in these two cases is a conflict between one group of workers, the wealthier Northern European workers, and another group of workers, the poorer Latvian workers, who are trying to get onto the labour market. And EU law does allow Latvian workers to do so. Now, if you're Latvian, you clearly think EU law is a very good thing. If you are Northern European, you might think that EU law is much less of a good thing. And that's why the TUC is somewhat ambiguous or ambivalent about EU membership, because on the one hand, yes, EU law has given workers a number of rights, but on the other hand, it has had this deregulatory effect. And this deregulatory effect can also be seen in the EU 2020 programme. Now, this usually has the effect of making everyone glaze over, so I won't talk about it for long, but it's actually the main area of activity now for all member states. And basically it's a reporting mechanism where states have their employment policies looked at, amongst all sorts of other policies as well, have their budgets examined. They're all carefully looked at. And the effect of this is that there are recommendations which are made to each member state about how they can improve their employment laws. And these are known as CSRs, country-specific recommendations. And these CSRs are seen in part to be deregulatory, particularly in the southern states which have high levels of employment protection. And the argument is that the high levels of national employment protection hinder the operation of the market. It makes employers much less willing to hire workers because it's so difficult to fire them. And so often the prescriptions against Italy and Spain is to cut their labour standards. And just remember what I said at the beginning, that as far as employment law is concerned, a lot of it is national competence. Rules on dismissal are national competence. And yet, through this EU 2020 mechanism, the EU is interfering with the operation and saying, look, we've got all of these rules, you've got these rules in the member states. Those rules interfere with the free operation of the labour market. They've got to be removed. So you do have this further deregulatory effect. Interestingly, the EU 2020 programme says virtually nothing to the UK about its employment laws, which perhaps is not surprising, because if you look at the OECD data, we have the second most flexible labour market in the world after America. So, in fact, as far as the EU 2020 process is concerned, the UK is seen to be a model state, but other member states suffer because of that. My final point is where EU law has been underwhelming. And the good example of that is the Charter of Fundamental Rights. Now, this is different to the Community Charter of 89. This is the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, which was actually agreed in 2000 but had legal effect in 2009. Now, the EU Charter is one of the things, again, that Boris Johnson focused on. And as you may know, for those of you who are not lawyers, you might think that with the Charter we have an opt-out from the Charter, because Tony Blair came back from negotiations in Brussels to say we've got an opt-out, and the opt-out is found in Protocol 30. Now, in fact, we do not have an opt-out. We don't have a general opt-out from the Charter, and that was conceded by Theresa May in a case called NS. Saidi, it's the same case. Theresa May said we do not have an opt-out from the Charter. So it is well known in legal circles, contrary to what the political rhetoric might be, that we do not have an opt-out from the Charter of Fundamental Rights. However, there is one possible area where we do have an opt-out, and that is in respect of the so-called solidarity title of the Charter. And the solidarity title of the Charter is the bit of the Charter which contains the social rights. Right to information and consultation, right to collective bargaining, right to collective action to go on strike, right to rest breaks. All of those rights are in the solidarity title. And what our so-called opt-out says is that if those rights are in fact rights and not principles, and I'll explain that in a moment, if the solidarity title contains rights, not principles, then they will not apply to the UK. Now, rights are things that you can actually enforce in your national courts. Principles are much softer. And what's been interesting is that the Court of Justice has sent out a message that those solidarity rights are in fact merely principles, and so much softer, have a much softer legal effect than rights. And therefore, because they are probably principles, despite the word right in the title, because they are probably only principles, therefore the opt-out doesn't need to be engaged, because they are not the hard rights that people thought they were. So the Charter doesn't really give much social protection. And indeed, worse still from a trade union perspective is that in an infamous case called Alamo Heron, the court used the Charter to strike down protection laid down in a directive. So that's why I say the Charter has been somewhat underwhelming if you're looking at this from a worker's perspective as opposed to an employer's perspective. Finally, if we stay in the EU, does this mean that there'll be lots and lots of new employment rights that workers will get? Well, the answer to that question is no. For Eurozone states, if there is a much greater centralisation, there may be, down the line, some attempt at having some sort of social welfare insurance, so that if you've got a very bad economic situation in one member state, there may be some sort of transfer of funds from the richer states to the states that are struggling. There might be some form of Eurozone unemployment insurance, which is, as you can see, a far shift from what you had at the beginning. At the beginning, you had nothing to do with social policy in the broad sense. This would be a big change. But for the non-Eurozone states, of course, including the UK, the cupboard is almost bare. There are no new serious rights apart from what was published yesterday, some more rights on posted workers, that is, workers temporarily working in the UK. But the numbers there are very small indeed, so will not make a big impact on most workers in the UK. So the bottom line is that if we stay in the European Union after the 23rd of June, workers will continue enjoying a lot of the rights, all the rights I've already mentioned to you, but they will not expect to get many more. Thank you very much indeed.